We mustn't rest until everything inside us worships God.
This is Mission 66. In partnership with Dr. Luis Seau and TWR, we bring Scripture to life chapter by chapter. Today, we join John Matthews and Esther Sisulu as they discuss the book of Ezra, the rediscovery of God's law and plan for His kingdom. To guide your own discovery, download the free study guide at mission66.org. Let's look to see what the book of Ezra has for us today.
Welcome to our program where we read the Bible chapter by chapter and receive commentary from our Bible teacher, John Matthews. Now, today, we'll be opening up to the Old Testament book of Ezra. And he was a priest during the time of Judah's return from Babylonian captivity. Now, John will take us through the first three chapters of this book with the episode theme, God Keeps His Promises.
Thanks very much, Esther, and a very warm welcome to this latest episode of Mission 66. So good to have your company as we arrive at the book, as Esther said there, of Ezra, which has to do with this time period when the people of Judah were returning from this period of exile in Babylon. We're now in the Persian era, and Ezra the priest most likely writes this around the year 457 to 450 BC. Ezra was a priest who went to Babylon with the rest of the captives, but he returns to Jerusalem around 458 BC ahead of Nehemiah, which is the name of the next book, which we'll get to in Mission 66. Now, it's said that Ezra wrote most of 1st and 2nd Chronicles that we've just covered on Mission 66, also the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah, as well as Psalm 119. And the book of Ezra centres on God's promise made through Jeremiah the prophet that the Judeans would return to their land 70 years after being captured by the Babylonians. Now, God always keeps his promises. So next, let's explore what happens at the beginning of Ezra chapter 1 when it speaks of those exiles returning to Judah and Jerusalem from Babylon. And the first part of this is really a repeat of what is written at the end of 2 Chronicles, and it's a decree by Cyrus. This is verse 1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, it said, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. And let each survivor in whatever place he sojourns be assisted by the men of his place with silver and gold, with goods and with beasts, besides freewill offerings for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. Then rose up the heads of the fathers' houses of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose spirit God had stirred to go up to rebuild the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem. And all who were about them aided them with vessels of silver, with gold, with goods, with beasts, and with costly wares, besides all that was freely offered. Cyrus the king also brought out the vessels of the house of the Lord that Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and placed in the house of his gods. Cyrus, king of Persia, brought these out in the charge of Mithridath the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar the prince of Judah. And this was the number of them: 30 basins of gold, 1,000 basins of silver, 29 censers, 30 bowls of gold, 410 bowls of silver, and 1,000 other vessels. All the vessels of gold and of silver were 5,400. All these did Sheshbazzar bring up when the exiles were brought up from Babylonia to Jerusalem. Well, Ezra chapter 2 has the details of who returns from the Babylonian captivity, and there were about 50,000 who made this first journey. We're not going to read the entire chapter, not because it's not important, but it's because it contains a long list of those families who made the return. You can certainly read those for yourself. I think it's really important to understand what's happening here and the context of this return. So remember that the people had gone into exile in Babylon when Judah and Jerusalem fell to Nebuchadnezzar. Groups were taken away in 605 BC, 597 BC, and finally with the destruction of the city Jerusalem in 586 BC before Christ. And eventually, though, the Babylonian Empire weakens and it's taken over by the Medes and the Persians in one night. We read about Belshazzar's feast in the book of Daniel and the supernatural handwriting that appears on the wall, signalling Belshazzar's demise and the rise of the Persian Empire. And Belshazzar, in fact, was killed that very night, and the Medes and the Persians take over when the prophet Daniel was advanced in age. And so now this return begins. The first return is led by Zerubbabel. Much later, in 458 BC, the second return occurs under Ezra. Finally, about 14 years after Ezra's time, there is a third return, and that is led by Nehemiah. Now we're going to read Ezra chapter 3 in its entirety because it's important, and we'll get a picture of the impact that the return was making on the hearts of the returning captives. So this is Ezra chapter 3. When the seventh month came, and the children of Israel were in the towns, the people gathered as one man to Jerusalem. Then arose Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, with his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, with his kinsmen. And they built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. And they set the altar in its place, for fear was on them because of the peoples of the lands. And they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, burnt offerings morning and evening. And they kept the feast of booths, as it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings by number according to the rule, as each day required. And after that, the regular burnt offerings, the offerings at the new moon, and at all the appointed feasts of the Lord, and the offerings of everyone who made a freewill offering to the Lord. From the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord. But the foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid. So they gave money to the masons and the carpenters, and food, drink, and oil to the Sidonians and the Tyrians, to bring cedar trees from Lebanon to the sea, to Joppa, according to the grant that they had from Cyrus, king of Persia. Now in the second year after their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, made a beginning, together with the rest of their kinsmen, the priests and the Levites and all who had come to Jerusalem from the captivity. They appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to supervise the work of the house of the Lord. And Jeshua with his sons and his brothers, and Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, together supervised the workmen in the house of God, along with the sons of Henadad and the Levites, their sons and brothers. just for the record here, Zerubbabel was one of the civic leaders, while Joshua, the priest, was the religious leader. There was no separation of church and state at this point. Both were working together, like one of those instances where government and the church works together to advance the kingdom of heaven. And this is verse 10. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests in their vestments came forward with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord, according to the directions of David, king of Israel. And they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, singing, "For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever toward Israel." And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first house, wept with a loud voice when they saw the foundation of this house being laid, though many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the joyful shout from the sound of the people's weeping. For the people shouted with a great shout, and that sound was heard far away. You see, this mixture of joy and tears was almost overwhelming as people celebrated the return and the fulfillment of God's promises.
You're listening to Mission 66, and we invite you to join the Mission 66 conversation on our social media platforms. Now, visit us today on Facebook and Instagram by searching Mission 66. And then you can interact with our community by leaving your comments or your questions. Now, speaking of which, we're going to proceed to our question time with our teacher, John. And I want to start off with those first verses that we read in Ezra, John, because they draw our attention to this Persian king, King Cyrus. Now, he was the one who actually made the declaration for the Judeans to return from captivity after 70 years. But I think, surely, as God being sovereign, he knew this was going to happen, because it was known as the captivity that would last for 70 years.
Yeah, I imagine it would be a different thing when you're living in captivity and are waiting for that to come true. But you're right, we go to a prophecy in Isaiah chapter 44, which mentions Cyrus by name. Let me read this part of the Bible to you. It's Isaiah 44, verse 28, and it reads, "Who says of Cyrus, 'He is my shepherd, and he shall fulfill all my purpose,' saying of Jerusalem, 'She shall be built,' and of the temple, 'Your foundation shall be laid.'" Now, what's really remarkable, Esther, about that is that Isaiah ministered around 150 years before the Babylonians even took the Judeans into captivity. So here's Isaiah speaking through the inspiration of God some, 150 plus 70, 220 years before, predicting not only the Babylonian captivity of Judah, but also predicting their return and the restoration of the temple, and actually mentioning Cyrus by name. Well, this was long before the city was taken and the temple was destroyed. And let me show you another example of prophetic insight regarding the Babylonian captivity, because the prophet Jeremiah, who came after Isaiah, said in chapter 25, verse 11, "This whole land," said Jeremiah, "shall become a ruin and a waste, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then, after 70 years are complete, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, the land of the Chaldeans, for their iniquity, declares the Lord, making the land an everlasting waste." So both Isaiah and Jeremiah have predicted that Judah, because of their sin, would be taken captive into Babylon and that it would last for 70 years. And then this king called Cyrus would be the one connected to the return and the restoration of Jerusalem. Now think of it. Only God could have known how long that Babylonian captivity would last, and only he could have known that Babylon would be overrun by Persia, where Cyrus, the very name, would be the king.
Oh, so interesting. And another thing that's interesting to note is how Cyrus acknowledges the God of heaven. In fact, he acknowledges the people of God. Now, obviously, King Cyrus had his own gods that he was worshipping. But John, where do you think this piety came from? I mean, could we conclude that maybe he converted somehow to Judaism?
Well, we don't know that because the Bible doesn't tell us, Esther. But Cyrus, being the king of Persia, lived in this polytheistic society that believed in the existence of many gods. And Cyrus, as history itself bears witness, was a really benevolent king who was somebody who knew how to skillfully manage political relations with conquered peoples. So he had this respect of religions of other people. Historical accounts, actually, Esther, from the Persian Empire show that Cyrus did his best to restore the gods and the temples of other peoples, not just the Judeans. So he's practicing this kind of good neighbor policy, I suppose you could call it that, trying to maintain peaceful dominance over the various nations under his rule by allowing them to exercise culturally what was their way and their religions. So when he declares that God, the God of Israel, is the God of heaven, well, I think he's responding to what he had heard said about this God. But his understanding has its limits because he mistakenly states that God, this particular God, is located in one place. So he doesn't go as far as to say that God is omnipresent. That means he's everywhere. And the prophets make it clear that the Lord is the God of the entire earth. So Cyrus is certainly used by God to bring about his purpose and see that the Judeans are returned and the temple is eventually restored. But this shouldn't be as some kind of proof text to say that Cyrus was saved or converted to anything that we, you know, as far as we can read here in the Bible.
All right, got it. Well, chapter 2 actually lists the names of all the returnees to Jerusalem, and I don't know, Ezra really took some painstaking efforts to record the names of every family that made the return. Why was this exercise so important?
Well, as we've already seen in Mission 66, genealogies are important because, one, they work through and clearly show God's plan being traced through the generations. And they were important to the Judeans for a number of reasons. Mainly, I think it showed this continuity between Judah before the families were taken captive and after. How else, you know, would these returnees be able to prove that they had rights to plots of ground owned by their forefathers before this period of 70 years in captivity, if they could accurately show that their family line was connected to one of the original landowners? Well, then they were able to prove that they were entitled to repossess the land. And so accuracy is important, and Ezra deserves a lot of credit for making sure the record is indeed accurate and clearly defined. So there's a list of everybody who returns. It starts with references to ordinary people. Then it mentions the priests and those connected to worship, followed by a detailed list name by name. And this is important for other reasons besides, because for one thing, it marks the fulfillment of God's prophetic word from many years before. Many who awaited this promise, they're listed here, along with the descendants of those who heard the prophecies. And the details, including, in fact, the objects that were taken to Babylon and are now being returned, they're also accounted for. And it marks the timeline. We have a precise date for this event. It's around 538 BC, which is during Cyrus's reign. It shows as well that the Bible is not just a figment of somebody's imagination. It is in part a history book, but it's not just that either. It's a book that demonstrates that God knows the end from the beginning. It's his span of history throughout. And when God makes a promise, we know that he keeps it. And it's done in a clear and an undeniable way. In other words, history may report on the Babylonian captivity and on the date of the Judeans' return, but it's the word of God that shows that God had predicted what was coming. And indeed, if we push on into the New Testament, we can still open that book and see what is coming ahead of us today.
Well, Don, there is a very interesting man with an interesting name, Zerubbabel. So who was this guy?
So he was one of the civic chiefs who survived captivity, and he was the grandson, actually, of King Jeconiah, who was one of the last kings of Judah.
Yeah, well, you know, in the biblical narrative, it actually says that Zerubbabel led the first group of Jews. But then there's also a guy named Sheshbazzar. He was the prince of Judah. So who exactly led the return? Was it Zerubbabel or Sheshbazzar? Or are they perhaps the same person?
No, they're not the same person. Zerubbabel was the prominent popular leader who truly spearheaded this return. He was listed as the son of Shealtiel, which was not the same line as Sheshbazzar. And in chapter 1, we see that Sheshbazzar was in charge of the temple objects that were going to be brought back to Jerusalem.
Well, you know, there is something I observed in chapter 3, and it has to do with the building of the altar and the temple, even before the rebuilding of the wall of the city. And just in my own deduction process, this shows that there was so much importance given to worship and to praise.
Yeah, it's really prominent, isn't it? And we know, Esther, that worship and adoration of God is one of the central themes of the Bible. The hymn writer A.W. Tozer once said, "We must never rest until everything inside of us worships God." And the way that God is approached here is through sacrifice. That is the central focus. So the altar is built first, then the temple. For 70 years, the Judeans hadn't performed any of the sacrifices required by the law. They weren't able to. They couldn't. They'd been removed from their homeland, the temple destroyed. But during their captivity, the concept of the synagogue emerged, small groups where there were at least 10 Jewish families. And during that time, well, they must have had time to reflect on their past history. And so when the people returned from captivity, they are ready to restore the altar and indeed the temple.
Something that really touched my heart, John, was the response of the people when the temple was rebuilt. I mean, it says that they were both crying and rejoicing all at the same time, so much so that there wasn't a distinction between which was which. I mean, it's quite a touching moment.
Yeah, it is. And the younger guys who wouldn't have had any knowledge of the Jerusalem temple worship as it used to be, they were cheering and celebrating. But it says, interestingly, that the older people who had remembered the glory of Solomon's great temple, well, some of those shed tears, perhaps because of the memory of what was lost, but more likely gratefulness to God for his love and his faithfulness in fulfilling his promise, in seeing the day of coming home.
Well, I think this was a great start to the book of Ezra, John. So how do we summarize all three chapters?
Well, Ezra outlines the return of the Judeans from Babylonian captivity during the Persian era, fulfilling, in fact, God's promise through Jeremiah that that exile would last 70 years. And the book begins with Cyrus, king of Persia, issuing this decree to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Prophecies by Isaiah and Jeremiah predicted the Babylonian captivity, its duration, and the fact that a king called Cyrus would give this order for the Judeans to return to their homeland, which confirms that God knows the end from the beginning and he always keeps his promises. And the return, well, it occurred in three waves. There was a civic leader called Zerubbabel who led the first group back in 538 BC. Ezra followed in 458 BC. And Nehemiah would complete the return, rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem 14 years later. Ezra 2, chapter 2, lists families who returned, emphasizing the genealogical lines to reclaiming ancestral land and fulfilling God's promises. And worship is central for these returnees who prioritize rebuilding the altar, offering sacrifices before they construct the temple. And then Ezra 3, we see these mix of emotions as the temple's foundation again is laid, young people rejoicing, those who are older, some of them weeping, remembering Solomon's grand temple that had been torn down by the Babylonians. And in future chapters, Esther, we're going to see a revived people.
Well, dear friends, we certainly encourage you to stay with us here on Mission 66 as we get to those future chapters. Well, this is where we'll leave it for today, and we hope you'll join us same time, same place as we continue in the book of Ezra. So until then, from myself, Esther, and John, saying see you next time, and may God bless you.
As Mission 66 comes to a close, be sure to download your free study guide at mission66.org. Deepen your daily devotion with insights from each episode, and let John and Esther lead you through the scriptures. Get your study guide at mission66.org and be prepared for our next episode. There, you can also connect with us, ask questions, or donate to help Mission 66's worldwide outreach. Head to mission66.org. Mission 66 is made possible through Transworld Radio in partnership with Dr. Luis Seau.